Blog Talk Radio.
Effects. I'm so happy to have you join me again today. It's to talk about this system of thinking, the system of thought called Freemasonry. It's not the only one in the world, as you know, but it is the one that has attracted our attention, and it gives us reason to explore. I may feel as I do, the benefit of Masonry becomes more multidimensional when we are able to discuss. It teaches us that there are more than our own perspectives, that our singular way of thinking is for us. It reminds us that to acknowledge the other minds, active minds, working with the concepts of Freemasonry, will expose that entire range of opinion that's always out there around us. It also reminds us that although we leverage the information of Freemasonry by organizing it in a framework of groups. There is an emphasis on group and on discussion as well as on mentoring. But it also points out to us that the conclusions that we draw, whether we assimilate those new ideas, fresh ideas, as a rethink of our own condition and then apply them, is entirely the prerogative of the individual, and the process alone establishes that while we are parts of groups, these final elements, the final stages, not that we get there just because we are thinking about it, but is singular. It's alone. So let's assume that we have a whole variety of opinions about such things, and we'll. And I apologize today. We're having for those who are tuning in. I'm having some overlap of the systems. Can't explain it any other way because I don't have the technical capability. But I hope that I've got it ironed out now. Apart from that, the program today is I think one that's interesting. the commentary, Learning to Tell the Difference, I think is, again, it's simply a reminder of what's going on. We may have a lot of people wanting to explain to us that their way of thinking is better for us and trying to persuade us that we ought to consider their way of thinking and their priorities for us. But I think it's more satisfying to realize that for all of their efforts, it's simply an awakening of this tremendous amount of communication that goes on around us all the time and always have. In a way, it reminds me of that question, if a tree falls in the forest and there's nobody around to hear it, is there a sound? Well, I think there is. The sound is in one instance, I'd suggest to you, the sound is in the perception, and without perceiving it, that it doesn't exist. And I think there is some merit to that, but the ideas do creep into existence when we begin to define them. But as you can think, as you examine that, it's really a slavish notion of empiricism, isn't it? If I can't see it, if I can't experience it, then it doesn't exist. I'm not too sure about that anymore. Within that framework, Masonry has, for quite some time, exposed our thinking and to redefining what and who we are, and prompting us in a way to begin to think about our purpose. And to wrestle with these ideas of intended purpose. If mathematics controlled everything, it would also include a formula for chaos, a formula for randomness, for destiny. And in some theory, it does. I have to be convinced of that. That there are more answers to these overriding questions than I may know, than any one person may know. But the learning and adapting is a prerogative, and what you absorb. But we don't refer to it like that. We generally refer to that as a man's taste or his chosen path, or a reflection of his abilities and ambitions or opportunities, depending on the situation that we're in. There's different ways of explaining it. And that's the interesting reflection on the craft, that there is no one way of one context for this. It's like if I was to say to you that there's only one context for your life, it would be ignoring that notion that we can never jump into the same river twice, because the river has continued to move along, and it's different in its composition, but so are we. Moments later, from the one point in time to another, you and I have also progressed and changed in some ways that may be the minutiae that we overlook, but nevertheless, if we're getting into the discussion about change, then things change around us. The universe changes around us constantly. So constantly in motion, and so the interesting part is noticing that we are, and when we think about things at a molecular and atomic levels, then we begin to, and it's more than theory, I would think, But we are also telling people that, you know, there's more going on than what you can see. There's even if we look down at our own hand, there's structure in there. It's this environment all on its own that works, and it's intact. You know, it's like these beautiful systems, and but we can't necessarily see. You would say, of course, Graham, we've created equipment that allow. Yes, of course, we've created equipment that allows us these beautiful pictures of what's going on inside. Better than, I suppose, eviscerating somebody to look at their anatomy and start to draw it, though that at one point that was the way we learned, and we're curious beasts, and there you go. I wonder sometimes about it, the test for our values, and whether we get to the point of just a resignation. I think it's we're more vulnerable to resignation when we are, in fact, living more isolated, when we're living in our own heads with our own thoughts. I think that's very, very difficult because of the vulnerability it draws. I won't say that's happening wholesale, but I will say today we're more aware of these processes. The internet is changing us. It's changing the way we go about our business, and it's changing thinking. And it's not a matter of whether we want it or not. It's like wanting sun, the warmth of the sun, or the nurturance of a spring shower. it's there. Now, we are almost weekly gaining reports of what science is doing for us, and it's hard to put that into a category. We're looking at information, images sent to us of processes like a nebula that happened billions of years ago. When you think about it, we're getting information today. Let's say it's one of these new planet system, galaxy systems. And we can trace back that the information is about, let's say, I think the most recent one I've picked up was about 3.5 billion years ago. And then we begin to realize these signals were sent before the Earth was formed. Yeah? And it's, it gives us, I guess, I think, another way of understanding that we are not on the same, all in the same time frame. The world that we experience is localized, but out there in the ether, that we are also part of this system of this huge thing we refer to as the universe, hundreds of billions of light years across. How to think about that? 350 billion light years across. The enormity is lost to the likes of me. I have a hard time conceptualizing something like that, even to hold the idea in mind. I need some representation in front of me so I can think through the proportionality of what we're talking about. But even then, we're at different points in time. I like I guess you could say I'm sentimental about the simplicity of my own ignorance. I liked when I had a sense that there was a predictability that the world was as I had been taught. Sun came up, the sun came down. That didn't happen. The sun doesn't come up, the sun doesn't go down. Then I learned about orbits and tilts, and we just passed the spring equinox, didn't we? We learn about them more, and it wasn't off-putting or oh bother. I liked it when it was so much simpler when I was stupid or when I was uninformed. I think the curiosity is, oh yeah, what? How does that happen? You tend to forget that we all begin in some limited way with the limit, you know, dealing with the limits around us. And as I keep hearing, if you put, you know, you want to teach your children, if they put their mind to it, they can achieve anything. Well, I wish that Malcolm Gladwell helped that. And we may not like Malcolm Gladwell's work and we may not embrace it, but what he did for us that I think was wonderful was triggered this process for a lot of us of asking questions or noticing things, noticing that things happen for reasons. And he speculated on those reasons in a very, very interesting way that's hard to, it may not be the complete science of, but it's a wonderful conversation starter. It's more than that. It connects us with so much science and so much mathematics that, you know, his place is significant. And yes, we have, people like me began to look for other similar thinkers. And it's remarkable when you look for it, out of all the material that's swirling around us and sent to us every day, every hour, every moment, there are some that are more, if more selective than others. There are some that are more pivotal, that are give us a richer bearing because they're of the detail and the depth that the author went into. And so Gladwell triggered that process for us. When you apply those kind of the Gladwellian idea of just scratch the surface and just tell us the story. Why did that happen? Well, you know, when you're looking at one that comes immediately to mind is the cockpit activity of the Korean flight that crashed into the side of a mountain for lack of priority, a struggle with the priority, tradition and the immediacy of the situation and politeness. Even to one's death. We have a good program today. I won't belabor it. I think it's a good one, even in spite of myself here. Remember, this is only the conversation starter. So you fellows in Brazil and South Africa, remember, this is only a pause. We'll have part of the conversation started here today until I can sit down with you or you sit down with your mates over a table, your best mates, and you talk. Then you explain to the world how foolish this all was and how it has just an absolute waste of time until somebody suggests that maybe it isn't. And then you're off in your own way. You fellas from Serbia, it's such a pleasure to have you pulling up to the table with us and with our colleagues from the Philippines and Greece and Britain. It is an interesting crowd, and this wouldn't be proper to consider this a balanced Masonic crowd without including the Americas. And I'm very grateful. Although I must admit, I'm curious about what part or what Grand Lodges are being represented here. But that's inappropriate for me. It doesn't matter. What matters is that you are men dedicated, people, humans dedicated, and that you have a sense of obligation as duty. Some do not. Where I am, we have been led to believe for quite some time that the obligation is voluntary. It's not in any way an official policy, but it's the interpretation. It's all about voluntary. However, it's a false notion, isn't it? You don't have to give your word. The craft goes out of its way to assure that you're doing it of your own free will. As you can imagine, it's not one. But what frames the whole process, what begins the whole process, isn't the assertions, it's the questions. The questions shape the course of our initiation. And some of those questions lead us to the fact that it's not been made clear. We were brought up in a good religious environments where everything was made clear. It wasn't necessarily in our best interest to do that in reflection. But what's undeniable is the beauty of a person's faith. There's times when I think that it's remarkable. And there's other times when I think, oh my goodness, it's such a barrier. And who am I to, I'm not a theologian, I'm not never claimed to be the scholar that you are, but I do recall that I am in, the comfort for me is that I'm in a world of experts. The world around me, full of experts. Every single person is certainly more expert about themselves than I am about them. I hope you'll enjoy the show. I'm chattering on only because I'm excited about what's coming up. But to treat you to a bit of brain candy, we have some music here, if you don't mind. And this is one of my favorite performers, as you know. You've heard him before on the show, Bill Evans. Let's get on with this, shall we? the Bill Evans Trio. Apologize for that. That was an indulgence. It's a tune he titled Peace, Peace, P-E-A-C-E, P-I-E-C-E, and given what's going on in the world around, you know, it's not just a thought, it's something that I believe is necessary and must prevail. The madness and the mad hatters that create it are not defining anything. That's not power. That's abuse. So for the time being, let's put them out of mind. Here, something I offer this to just to stimulate. I thought of it while you were getting up to refill our glass of scotch. And I have this to say to you. Since we are the sole occupant of our own mind, can we assume we accept that individuality is the case for every living soul we meet? We perform certain tasks requiring careful preparation and coordination of large groups. The success of larger groups relies on each man, each person, understanding the collective achievement and the contribution of his particular talents. Fortunately, the craft produces so many choices. You may enjoy the knife and fork variety, fair play, while others pursue ideas and answers. While masonry may encourage us to believe there are no bounds to intellectual freedoms, the human boundaries are readily on display. We create a sacred space to protect our interests enough to allow us to explore vital questions. What a lodge concludes is entirely of their making. Think of it as the expression of masonry. There are features with which we declare our fidelity to universal Masonic thought and our threat to legitimacy. What we wear, how we conduct ritual, we assure dignity is not to be seen in earnest. We do have symbols in mind, mnemonics for those who locate and associate meanings with needs. Nishi helped clarify, you have your way, I have mine. As for the right way, the correct way, the only way, that does not exist. Fortunately, the craft embraces ethics, a means to calculate what to do in a given situation without reliance on assumptions, or too many of them. How daring, but if it does not hold some willing interest, it is only another imposition. Maybe we are destined to fly closer to the sun. Maybe. You never know, do you? Here. BG Adair. I think you'll like this. Sort of sets a mood, doesn't it? Yeah. Candlelight. The company of a beautiful woman. Yes. And your imagination. Thank you. I'm almost living a Bob Dylan dream. I begin to think that my companion is now chrome and buttons. I'll put this, you know, this is the portion of the show where I indulge us with poetry. The poet today, a young Indonesian fellow, Lai Yong Lee. It's beautiful. We'll get to that. It's his poem, Persimmons. It's just a gorgeous piece of work. Anyway, I asked ChatGPT the question. The question that's on my mind when I'm putting this show together. Tell me, I just want you to talk to me and teach me about your ideas on poetry and why it's essential. I would have the same conversation with many of you about our taste in music, and I would hope that we would, you know, there's lots of different versions of it, which is I find interesting, but I like to talk with somebody who has a different taste in music and helps me to understand the best part of their taste in music. And that's how I began to explore music a long time ago. Oh, yes, I liked my rock and roll, and then I began to learn its roots and to learn its diversity. And you have, you know, everything from the Frank Zappas and the Beatles to the ethereal kinds of material like Emerson, Lake and Palmer and King Crimson, and experimental music, so much out of the period when I was growing up was considered avant-garde. And for listeners around the world, it was like there was so much distinct style music coming out with no marketing. There were, okay, I'll give you that there had to be productions and studio time and all the rest of that. But they weren't manufactured is what I'm trying to say. They weren't trying to match a band, put it together, the music together to fit an algorithm. No, it's the other way. Those algorithms were based on all these strong characters and they're very distinctive music. You could turn from Van Morrison and Sly and the Family Stone to Jimmy Buffett to Neil Young and balladeers. But it comes back. As I've shared with you, my thinking that contemporary poetry is around us constantly, but it's sung to us. These are these short songs. Old men still mock the music of young girls, which I find tragic. And the world seems to struggle until they discover that battle between French poetry and English poetry. I think it's lovely. Here, what ChatGPT gave for the explanation, poetry is essential to thought because it offers a unique mode of expression that transcends conventional language boundaries, allowing for the exploration of complex ideas and emotions in a condensed and evocative manner. As T.S. Eliot noted, poetry communicates before it is understood, emphasizing its ability to engage with the subconscious and evoke deep reflection. Hear, hear. And we can see that in T.S. Eliot's work, The Use of Poetry and the Use of Criticism. Darn, that's a good one. That is a good one. Now, Lai Yong Lee, he was born in Jakarta, Indonesia in 1957. Oh my goodness, I can remember 1957. So I'm sorry, sir. I remember the period well. It was when life was so simple. The crack of the bat in September, there was the World Series and everybody tuned into those tiny little transistor radios with those great big long antennas. And it was simpler times. We played cowboys and Indians without giving a second thought to the reflection of racism and genocide. None of that. This was the age of preparation. It wasn't so much an age of innocence, but the age of preparation for what came very shortly after, when the big question happened: what in the hell is going on around here? And oh no, I'm not part of that. Here, this guy came. He was born to Chinese political exiles. Both his parents came from, it's said, from powerful Chinese families, but his great grandfather was the first president of the Republic of China. So a bit of a background, and his father was the personal physician to Mao Zedong. And in Indonesia, Dr. Li helped found Gamaleya University. Anti-Chinese sentiment began to foment in Indonesia, however, and his father, Li's father, was arrested and held as a political prisoner. But after his release, the family fled through Hong Kong, Macau, and Japan, and arrived in the United States in 1964. Now, I know many of you out there will have similar stories. I've had a much more predictable kind of existence. When I hear these things, it's like I have to sit back and just let it sink in. How that kind of story, I know you're resilient and I know you move on, but it's such a compelling history. So his parents moved from Seattle to Pennsylvania, west coast to east, and Dr. Li attended seminary and eventually became a Presbyterian minister in Vandergrift community. And his dad read to the boy frequently. Li didn't begin to be seriously interested in poetry until he was a student at the University of Pittsburgh, where he studied with, yes, get wait for it, Gerald Stern. Right on. So influenced by classical Chinese poets, Lai Bo and Tu Fu, Li's poetry is noted for its use of silence. And according to Alex Lemon in the Minneapolis Star Tribune, it's near mysticism, which is nonetheless fully engaged in life and memory while building and shaping the world, the self from words. What's another name for the totality of causes? If you rigorously dissect it, you realize that everything is a shape of the totality of causes. The other name, the cosmos. So everything is a shape of cosmos or God. It feels like something bigger than me and I can't possibly fathom, but am embedded in. Here. Persimmons by Lai Yong Li. It's a poem about family and the importance of language. Yeah, I think we can all relate to this in some way. It begins with the speaker in sixth grade, a little boy, being punished for not remembering the difference between two words, persimmon and precision. He proves in the following lines that he knows what a persimmon is, and proceeds to explore how important it is to his family and the memories of youth. He remembers sharing his language with his girlfriend, Donna, and how, in this instance, language was a beautiful thing. He also brings the reader to a powerful memory of his father, who, before and after going blind, was a prolific painter. He knew the persimmon so well, he didn't need to see it to depict it effectively. Now, let's see if you agree. The poem asserts that language is a way of connecting and distancing. The speaker feels othered due to his confusion regarding two words, precision and persimmon, at the beginning of the poem. Although looked down upon by his teacher and perhaps his classmates, he was well aware what a persimmon is and spends the rest of the poem depicting how integral the fruit is to memories of his youth and to his other family members. What do you think? Ready for this? This is an interesting poem, I think. It's just the setup. You can imagine it. you can imagine. My Young Lee. I'll pick this one up from Eastern Illinois University, and then it gets into the analysis. This is really a juicy one. In sixth grade, Mrs. Walker slapped the back of my head and made me stand in the corner for not knowing the difference between persimmon and precision. How to choose persimmons? This is precision. Ripe ones are soft and brown spotted. Sniff the bottoms. The sweet one will be fragrant. How to eat? Put the knife away. Lay down newspaper and peel the skin tenderly, not to tear the meat. Chew the skin and suck it in. Swallow. Now eat the meat of the fruit. So sweet, all of it, to the heart. Donna undresses, her stomach is white, in the yard, dewy and shivering with crickets, we lie naked, face up, face down. I teach her Chinese, crickets, do, I've forgotten, naked, I've forgotten, ni wo, you and me. I part her, remember to tell her she is beautiful as the moon. Other words that got me into trouble were fight and fright, wren and yarn. Fight was what I did when I was frightened. Fright was what I felt when I was fighting. Wrens are small, plain birds. Yarn is what one knits with. Wrens are soft as yarn. My mother made birds out of yarn. I love to watch her tie the stuff, a bird, a rabbit, a wee man. Mrs. Walker brought a persimmon to class and cut it up so everyone could taste a Chinese apple. Knowing it wasn't ripe or sweet, I didn't eat but watched the other faces. My mother said, persimmon has a sun inside, something golden, glowing, warm as my face. Once in the cellar, I found two wrapped in newspaper, forgotten, not yet ripe. I took them and set them both in my bedroom windowsill, where each morning a cardinal sang, the sun, the sun. I'll remember that the next time we hear a cardinal. Finally, understanding he was going blind, my father sat up all one night waiting for a song, a ghost. I gave him the persimmons, swelled, heavy as sadness and sweet as love. This year, in the muddy lighting of my parents' cellar, I rummage, looking for something I lost. My father sits on the tired wooden stairs, black cane between his knees, hand over hand, gripping the handle. He's so happy that I've come home. I ask how his eyes are, a stupid question. All gone, he answers. Under some blankets, I find a box. Inside the box, I find three scrolls. I sit beside him and untie three paintings by my father, hibiscus leaf, and a white flower, two cats preening, and two persimmons so full they want to drop from the cloth. He raises both hands to touch the cloth and asks, which is this? This is persimmons, father. Oh, the feel of the wolf tail on the silk, the strength, a tense precision in the wrist. I painted them hundreds of times, eyes closed. These I painted blind. Some things never leave a person. Scent of the air of one you love, the texture of persimmons. In your palm, the ripe weight. Oh, my goodness. Did he capture it for us? What do you say? What do you say to that? Here. Let's reflect on that a little bit. This is Oscar Peterson. I think that'll do. Beautiful piece of music. Do you remember I've been talking about the history of this new upstart kind of lodge in Salzburg? Their criticism was they were, you know, admitting people that weren't quite of a certain pedigree. I can sympathize with this, and I don't mean to cross purposes with this brilliant historian Margaret C. Jacob, but I can at least understand the criticism. If you had a thought that the atmosphere that you created in your lodge was correct, and anything else that wasn't consistent was somehow wrong. I can understand that sentiment because I've seen that and felt that happening, and I'm sure many of you have felt that. It's not unusual when you think that we come into an order where we have an implied consent to examine. To examine and rethink, and that's what we do. We begin without much training or, you know, control. We're not marched into, you know, taught. We're not taught like the legionnaires. Here's how you hold this, and here's how you think. This is when you eat, and this is when you sleep. No, but we all begin this emergent sense of our own translation of the term awareness. Awareness means paying attention in a general sense. And what we see, of course, isn't the training about analyzing the information. We're not necessarily taught the scientific method that every failure is taking us one step closer. So we run those repeated experiments, and we carefully define our values and our variables, and we want to have a dependent and independent. We understand the difference between those variables. We're not there. So of course, when you put a group together like that, the first thing that they will notice isn't the strengths and balance. It will be the wrongness, the difference, how you approach ideas that's different than my own. That's the emphasis. And then we without having much sense of ethics, like the calculation or the formula for understanding in a given context what the right thing to do is, we begin becoming quite judgmental, which feeds into this whole idea of little cliques. And that does happen. That's not a reflection of masonry. That's a reflection of us. That's human condition. No, but think here that we can make some observations historically, so they're nice and safe. We don't have a lot of emotion invested in what went on back then, but we can then safely and circumspectly approach these conditions in our own world. If you don't have these collisions of values and egos, well, you're a part of the beacon that we all strive to use as a guide. Here we're talking about that upstart lodge, the riffraff lodge, Saint Genevieve, as we open here, I'll just remind you that whatever quarrels Saint Genevieve may have had with the Grand Lodge in the past are forgotten in its ardor to see that the new lodge give to it a submission without limits of inviolable attachment, the prompt execution of decrees. The vision presented in the new lodge was almost utopian, almost feudal, as well as familial. In its sense of unity, order, and hierarchy of loyalty and obedience. Yet the language is cosmopolitan. Persons of all ages and all ranks. In reality, the lodge was composed entirely of men of the third estate. Immediately, the new lodge was told of the great prince to whom French Masons owe their happiness. The leaders of Saint-Genevieve, as we have seen, had no love lost for the local aristocracy, yet they were monarchists believing in the early 1780s, as did many French Freemasons, that Louis XVI would effect genuine reforms. He is compared to only one other French king, Henry VI, the Fourth, 1610, who granted French Protestants a limited toleration. They were unstinting in their praise of Louis. To be protected by a prince, the love of an entire nation, the benefactor of the universe, and the terror of his enemies. He holds first place amongst us. Masonry has triumphed in this time of reason and philosophy, the orator continues. I intend the art of Masonry to create the well-being of all men and to regard them all as brothers. Incapable of enthusiasm for all men are the inhuman egoists devoured by the ambition to cover their birth by the brilliance of their titles and the gifts of fortune. In contrast to the egoism of the titled and well-born stand those who shed their blood in defense of their country. The reputable bourgeois of all ranks, as the orator describes the new brothers, in the career of the sciences, have used the occasion to express their social and political antagonisms and loyalties. They have assembled out of the hearing of the other estates toward the end of the American War of Independence and hence away from the aristocracy. It is clear that these merchants and presumably the medical men who listened intently to their orations deeply disliked men of title and fortune. Masonic values could easily be seen to reinforce the bias against birth and toward virtue and merit. Historians know that in the 18th century, the vertical bonds uniting seigneurial society in France weakened as the horizontal bonds of class and profession strengthened. The Lodge of St. Genevieve offers further evidence of this both phenomena. And while reference is made to, quote, the people, in the discourses of St. Genevieve, it is addressed in Les Beaux-Arts, composed largely of brothers lower than themselves in the third estate. These merchant brothers save their ardor for attacking the pretensions of the aristocracy. The people, although to be pitied, are remote from these proceedings. Not least, the lodge could be quite dilatory in paying its brother servants, one of whom had a dun in it for money. Would we be so bold? Would we be so bold? I think these sentiments are not unique to this period of history. The safety is that history, that's so far away. I don't have any skin invested in that, in those events. And I'm not insulted by because I don't know the characters, but I do know those characters. I've met that type. I've faced that type of, and I think so have many of you. You've been in those kind of situations yourself, and you can relate in some way to what the author, the history is describing for us. Only we can safely reflect. And of course, when we do that, we always know better. We always have, because we have a sense of hindsight. When I'm looking at what you did 200 years ago, or 300 years ago, I can apply a sense of hindsight. And it's not so much a sense of superiority, it's a sense, truly. It's not smugness, it's a sense of understanding. We're simply, it reinforces the notion of rhetoric, of course. Can you have a discussion of idea without clouding it with rashness and emotional intelligence? Can you do that? Well, history does that for us. In some places, I'm not talking about the marches, you know, declaring the victory of an ancient battle that triggers a sense of resentment, as if poking a stick at a bear. I'm not talking about that at all. That's bad. I think that's bad manners. Maybe well-intended and purposeful, but it's just, it's poor form. We learn from this, and rightfully so. We have the advantage of history. But I am reminded that it challenges my old sense of reality. History exists in our imagination. It only exists in our minds. It was yesterday. It lingers. And what do we learn from it? Well, as a dear man said to me just a few days ago, if we don't learn from history, we're bound to repeat it. I'm sitting here looking at a painting that he gave me, and truly, it's a contemplative artist who gave me reason to contemplate. It's lovely. You've heard this piece of history. Now, how does it apply to your situation? Where I am, I'll be honest with you. My brethren, I don't find Masonry gender specific. I know the practice needs to be, but the ideas certainly aren't. It's like saying there's boy mathematics and there's girl physics. Yeah, right. That we wonder about the preparation and the selections. And I've been boldly going where most people with good taste would not, to suggest that we struggle with the sensibilities of selecting people, because we translate selection and the initiatic process into some sense of entitlement and judgment. And I tend to think of it more as descriptive. We have, thanks to your help and discussion, and I believe paying attention and a bit of intelligence, so we have a description in mind of the person that would thrive in our environment, thrive and connect with us in our character and our ambitions for a lodge. And the work of the selection is identifying those traits in curious people. And here where I am, we find that very, very difficult to do. So we abrogate that responsibility. It still gets done. That selection process, that careful selection process that has come down to us through history, it still gets done. But it's by default. These men self-select. And they come in large numbers and leave in large numbers. Meanwhile, we try to stay away from getting into the actual process, like what in the world is going on. Although I will admit it does cause alarm, but the discussion around it is complicated for people here. And as a result, we have some... We stumble along. We see processes and we aren't quite sure what needs to be done to change it. So again, it's just that idea of compatibility. We don't want to put a silk purse around sow's ears. We don't want to put a person into an environment they're not equipped to thrive. Not at these levels. This isn't about putting a person in a situation where they're going to be embarrassed. And I must say, I find intolerable or inexcusable are these displays of authority and that being the only answer to a lot of things going on, as just so beautifully ironic in a body of thought enriched and created with philosophical threads, to have that ignored for the rule of, and the exercise of authority, I find that is just the most striking fascinating irony, one of those beautiful ironies of masonry. Anyway, enough of me. A little bit of Brad Mindow. This is Bewitched, Bewildered, Bothered. It's a beautiful tune. Some of you will know it already. Brethren, I find myself interrupted by time again. This portion of the conversation, this ongoing conversation, needs to draw to some orderly conclusion for today. And we'll pick it up again, I promise. I must admit, the more I observe you and your work and your thinking, the more it helps me to connect with ancient landmarks. I would sincerely love to have you provide me with your observations. I know that's not necessarily something you're interested in as you're sitting back and relaxing and listening to this. But think of, you know, it's at least... From my perspective, when I think about a global masonry, it helps me to understand more deeply this thought system. And I find it more and more remarkable as I do. Not prideful. There's no bragging. It's like, I find that a bit offensive, somebody walking around trying to explain to me how smart they are all the time. I find that tedious, really. And I'm really, really, if anybody knows me, I'm just not a fan of people having to point out their greatness or their significance. I find that boring as hell. I prefer more the fellow that's confident in his own skin, confident and accepting of his own personality, so that he's able to laugh at himself in a sense of self-deprecating humor. I love that. When I think of you tuning in to this show, wherever you are in the world, I think of the likelihood that we are smiling at each other, that we're greeting each other, identifying each other, of course. And then going off on tangents, so many questions and our curiosity about one another. But carry that smile. I like that image. If I close my eyes right now, that's an image that I carry with me. And I extend that. It's not an assumption. It's a description that these values, the kind of people that you and I are, exist everywhere. And sometimes we're distracted and we're not at our best, but so life is what it is. And we also know, you and I, that what we see isn't always what is really going on. That what we see on the outside doesn't really reflect very much. People tend to be very, very private, don't they? They have that private sense of themselves, then they don't necessarily want to expose it because you and I are curious about it. Nevertheless, you'll come back and see me in a week. You'll come back and pull up a chair with me. I certainly hope so. And in the meantime, thank you very much. I'm very grateful. This has been a week of exceptional gratitude. I've had some gratifying experiences this week, I can assure you. And I'm not always sure I deserve them all, but they're wonderful and they're sincerely voiced. And so I extend that to you, to each one of you. Commit your acts of random Masonic kindness this week. And please include your loved ones, the things that you do without them necessarily being aware. I think that's magical myself. Bye for now. Thank you.